Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. The Islamic State's Egyptian branch has claimed responsibility for a bombing that killed seven people in a hotel in the North Sinai capital of Al-Arish on Tuesday, where judges overseeing a parliamentary election were staying. The statement by the Sinai Province group was circulated by its supporters on Twitter and the encrypted messaging system Telegram. A brother seeking martyrdom, the message says, with its car bomb, the security force protecting the Swiss Inn Hotel, where 50 judges were staying, only to be followed by a lion who broke into the judges' base with his automatic weapon, then blew up his explosives belt among them, according to the statement. A militant tried to drive a car bomb into the hotel before security forces opened fire on him, causing the car to explode. The official leading the investigation into the attack on the luxury hotel in Mali's capital is urging residents to keep an eye out for suspicious behavior and warns of heightened security threats. The prosecutor, Boubacar Siddiqui Samake, Tuesday provided scarce new information about the investigation into Friday's assault that killed 19 people. Pope Francis begins his first official visit to Africa on Wednesday, with stops planned in Kenya, Uganda, and the Central African Republic. It's a trip that human rights advocates hope he will use to press for expanded political rights, religious tolerance, and respect for minorities. A teenager has died in Liberia, and the first such death since the country has officially declared Ebola free from the virus in September, according to official Tuesday. The 15-year-old boy died on Monday. This is VOA News. French President François Hollande of France arrived Tuesday for talks with U.S. President Barack Obama on how to confront the threat posed by the Islamic State group in the wake of the Paris attacks. That's the sound of the French president's plane landing at Andrews Air Force Base outside the U.S. Capitol. The French president is currently at the White House with President Obama for talks, followed by a joint press conference. Hollande's trip to Washington is part of a frantic week of shuttle diplomacy by the French leader to rally global support to fight IS. Russian President Vladimir Putin has accused Turkey of stabbing Russia in the back and supporting terrorism after Turkish F-16 shot down a Russian Su-24 fighter jet on the border with Syria. Ankara said the plane was shot down Monday after it violated Turkish airspace and ignored 10 warnings in the span of 5 minutes to leave. Meanwhile, Moscow insists the jet never left Syrian territory. Meanwhile, Putin acknowledged that the Russian jet was shot down by the Turkish F-16s. Video from the area showed what appeared to be two pilots parachuting down from the sky, and a Syrian rebel group later released its own video of what it said that one of the pilots was dead. VOA Moscow correspondent Daniel Sharf sheds more light on the situation.
This is not the first time that we've seen tension along the border with Turkey with other Russian planes that did violate the Turkish border. The Russian side even admitted in October that some of their fighter jets had violated the Turkish border. They said it was by accident and blamed bad weather.
And that is VOA Moscow correspondent Daniel Sharf. U.S. stocks opened sharply lower Tuesday, joining European equity markets and retreating following news that Turkey shot down a Russian fighter jet on the Syrian border. 5 minutes into trade, the Dow Jones Industrial Average stood at 17,707.06, which is down 85.62%. The broad S&P 500 index dropped 9.46 or 45% to 2,077.13. Schools and the subway system remain closed Tuesday in Brussels, Belgium. That remains under tight security while authorities there are trying to find the key suspect in the November 13th Paris attacks. The Belgian Prime Minister said Monday that because a threat still exists in the capital, they will still be on the highest state of alert until next week. He said, however, the country wants to return to normal and schools will open on Wednesday, as well as trains running again in Brussels. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden is traveling Wednesday to Croatia to discuss the influx of migrants, energy issues, and the fight against terrorism with the Croatian officials and the European Council President Donald Tusk. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yis Wuhib. And coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
Pope Francis arrives in Uganda late Friday. Uganda has one of the largest Catholic communities in Africa, and the highlight of the Pope's visit will be the 50th anniversary celebration of the canonization of 22 Ugandan martyrs.
That's Gino Rosblad reporting from Kampala. Details coming up.
Also in the news, Belgium's prime minister says the capital will be on the highest state of alert until at least next week. And Burundi's government has suspended 10 civil society groups, accusing them of fueling violence that has left more than 200 dead since April.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Gabon, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, schools and the subway system remained closed today as Brussels remained under tight security. Authorities are searching for the key suspect in the November 13th Paris terrorist attacks. Belgium's Prime Minister Charles Michel says the capital will be on the highest state of alert until at least next week. But he said students would go back to school tomorrow and the trains in Brussels would be running. Meanwhile, Moroccan authorities say Belgium has asked for close and intense cooperation in tracking Paris suspect Salah Abdeslam. He avoided arrest since crossing into Belgium hours after the Paris attacks that killed 130 people. A Moroccan tip helped lead French police to an apartment in North Paris where another suspect, massacre architect Abdelhamid Abba Aoud, was killed in a November 18th raid. Elsewhere, police are analyzing an apparent suicide explosives belt found in a trash bin in a southern Paris suburb.
Earlier yesterday, Belgian prosecutors announced the arrests of 16 suspects who had been detained in 19 raids late Sunday in and near Brussels, which is also the headquarters of the European Union. Five more arrests were also announced yesterday. Late yesterday, the U.S. State Department issued a worldwide travel alert. It warned Americans that Islamic State extremists and other terror organizations continue planning attacks in multiple regions. The advisory urged particular caution during the upcoming holiday season.
French President Francois Hollande meets today with President Obama at the White House. Mr. Hollande met with British Prime Minister David Cameron yesterday and will hold talks later this week with the leaders of Russia, China, Germany, and Italy. The White House says the U.S. and French leaders will discuss further cooperation as part of the U.S.-led coalition conducting airstrikes against Islamic State targets. France is intensifying its attacks on Islamic State targets in Syria in the aftermath of the deadly Paris attacks. Russia has been bombing in Syria for nearly 2 months, but its campaign has faced criticism from Western governments. They say the strikes have focused on rebels opposed to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and not the Islamic State group. Today, Russian President Vladimir Putin has accused Turkey of stabbing Russia in the back and supporting terrorism after Turkish F-116S shot down a Russian Su-24 fighter jet on border with Syria. Ankara said the plane was shot down today after it violated Turkish airspace and ignored 10 warnings in the span of 5 minutes to leave. Moscow insists the jet never left Syrian territory.
Meanwhile, in Egypt, Islamic State militants claimed responsibility today for killing a judge, two policemen, and a civilian in a suicide bombing at a hotel in the northern Sinai Peninsula. Cairo says the assault wounded 12 other people. The attack occurred at the Swiss Inn in El Arish, where judges overseeing the country's parliamentary elections were staying. The military says troops and policemen opened fire on an explosive-laden car as it approached the hotel, blowing it up. But it says two militants slipped into the hotel. One detonated an explosives vest in the kitchen, while the other opened fire inside a hotel room. Egypt says three attackers were killed in the incident, but Islamic State says only two of its fighters carried out the assault. Meanwhile, in Niger, one of Africa's top fashion events, FEMA, was cancelled today over fears of terrorist attacks. The French news agency says Niger's government made the decision. About 1,000 people from 40 countries had planned to attend FEMA, which was due to begin tomorrow.
Malian authorities have asked the public for help in identifying two gunmen killed in the terrorist attack on a Bamako hotel Friday. That's because there are conflicting claims of responsibility from multiple jihadist groups in Mali. Authorities say 21 people were killed in the attack, while nearly 140 staff and guests from more than 20 countries were evacuated safely. Katerina Hoye has the latest on the investigation from Bamako.
4 days after the attack on the Radisson Blue Hotel in Bamako, the details remain unclear. Malian authorities say gunmen stormed the hotel early Friday, yelling Allahu Akbar, God is great, in Arabic. Some of the people killed were in the breakfast room, but there were also victims on the two uppermost floors. Some survivors said attackers spoke French. One hotel guest said they knocked on his door, claiming to be hotel security. There were at least two attackers, but as many as 10 by some reports. The count of survivors suggests there were 4 or 5 gunmen. Amadou Sango of Ministry for Security and Civil Protection says investigators are working to identify the two gunmen whose bodies were found at the scene.
The two terrorists, on an appel à témoins pour demander au parler aux populations si toutefois.
He says more than one group has claimed responsibility, but he will not speculate about which group committed the attack. Sango says when the gunmen are identified, investigators might also be able to determine which group executed the attack. The first jihadist group to take responsibility for the attack has identified two gunmen, Abdel Hakim al-Ansari and Mouad al-Ansari. Sango could not confirm those were the men in the photos released by authorities. That group, al-Murabitun, or the Sentinels, released a tweet as the 7-hour siege was ending Friday and then an audio message to a Mauritanian news site Monday. Al-Murabitun is a fusion of two al-Qaeda-linked groups in northern Mali. The group is believed to still be led by long-time Algerian jihadist Mokhtar Belmokhtar. Belmokhtar masterminded the 2012 attack on a gas plant in In Amenas that killed at least 67 people, many of them foreigners. But another jihadist group called the Messina Liberation Front, active primarily in central Mali, said Sunday in a statement to French media that there were 5 gunmen at the Radisson and 3 of them escaped. The MLF claimed the attack as a joint operation with Ansadin, another Malian jihadist movement in the north. The MLF attacked a hotel in the central Malian town of Sévre in August, holding staff and guests hostage and killing 13 people. The contradictory claims of responsibility for the Bamako attack could suggest a power struggle among jihadist groups operating in Mali. New groups have formed as others have fractured. Membership has at times overlapped. The confusion underscores the security challenges Mali faces now almost 3 years after the start of an international military intervention in the north. Katerina Hayek for VOA News, Bamako.
Burundi's government has suspended 10 civil society groups. It accuses them of fueling violence that has left more than 200 dead since April. Reuters reports that most of the groups are led by prominent human rights activists who are now in exile. Burundi's interior minister says investigations have revealed their efforts to disturb security in the country. Violence first erupted when President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term in office, despite opposition cries that it was unconstitutional. In related news, the African Union Peace and Security Council has postponed deploying peacekeepers in Burundi. Instead, it voted to send more observers, including military, police, and human rights experts. Yesterday, the U.S. imposed sanctions on 4 current and former government officials. It said the violence and turmoil in Burundi poses a national security risk.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehisu Heeb, 15 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Belgium's prime minister says the capital will be on the highest state of alert until at least next week. Malian authorities have asked the public for help in identifying two gunmen killed in the terrorist attack on a Bamako hotel Friday. And Burundi's government has suspended 10 civil society groups, accusing them of fueling violence that has left more than 200 dead since April. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Pope Francis arrives in Uganda late Friday. Uganda has one of the largest Catholic communities in Africa. The highlight of the Pope's visit will be the 50th anniversary celebration of the canonization of 22 Ugandan martyrs. Sergino Rusblad reports from Kampala.
Workers are putting the finishing touches on the preparations of the Namugongo Shrine in Kampala. As many as 2 million people are expected here Saturday for a mass with Pope Francis. This is one of Africa's most important Catholic shrines, says Director Reverend Vincent Lubega. Thousands of pilgrims walk here every June to pay tribute.
So Namugongo is important and the center of all the martyrdom because the head of the group was martyred here.
In 1886, 22 Catholic converts were killed by the Bugandan king for their refusal to renounce Christianity. In 1964, Pope John Paul VI canonized the group, and now, half a century later, the leader of the Roman Catholic Church will mark the occasion.
He will come over through that door, kneel here before the relics, and say a prayer in silence.
40% of Ugandans are Catholic, one of the largest communities in Africa. Church members outside Rubaga Cathedral, the oldest church in Uganda, say the visit is a blessing. This is Uganda's third papal visit. The previous two were in 1969 and 1993.
We are very happy that the Pope is coming. This is a long time since the other Pope was here.
The excitement is palpable and good for business, say street vendors.
We are selling T-shirts with the Pope, an emblem, badges, the Vatican flag, the umbrella, all of them, including the photo of the Pope.
The Archbishop of Gulu, John Baptiste Odama, says the Pope's timing is good as Uganda is heading to what are expected to be particularly contentious elections in early 2016.
His coming has rallied us all together, the government, the church, and the population at large.
Church leaders cannot say what exactly the Pope will discuss in Uganda, but global inequality has become one of his signature issues.
What does he normally do? In many other countries, he talks about the rights of the poor. The sick should not be neglected. They should be supported by the governments.
Ugandans say they eagerly await the Pope's message. Serginho Rosblat for VOA News, Kampala.
In related news, an international human rights organization says Pope Francis' visit to Kenya, Uganda, and Central African Republic will be a key moment to stand with victims of abuses. Human Rights Watch is calling on the Pope to speak out strongly on matters of justice, civil and political rights, religious tolerance, and respect for sexual and gender minorities. Annika van Woudenberg is a spokesperson for Human Rights Watch. From London, she explains why the Pope's visit could help alleviate the suffering of those whose rights are being violated.
Well, it's certainly a historic trip for Pope Francis. It's his first time coming to Africa as Pope, and apparently his first visit to Africa ever. And of course, Africa is enthralled by this Pope, much like other parts of the world. I think there will be a lot of eyes and ears on the Pope over the coming days, and what he says about some of the key issues facing Africa is going to be closely followed and paid attention to.
And one of those big issues is human rights abuses that are taking place, for instance, in the Central African Republic. So how do you think he is going to address this issue of human rights abuses?
Well, this, of course, is going to be hopefully a critical part of his mission. He is going to three countries which have gone through significant human rights abuses in recent years, and the Central African Republic still in the middle of it. He'll start his visit in Kenya and then on to Uganda. And both those two countries, of course, have had historical violence, especially around the time of elections, and in those two countries still a lack of justice for much of the violence that has taken place, including in Kenya, the terrible violence that occurred during the 2007-2008 electoral crisis, where over 1,000 people died, 650,000 were displaced. There's still no real justice for that. Same in Uganda, where he will be going, where there has also been significant human rights abuses by Ugandan security forces, both in their fight against a rebel group known as the Lord's Resistance Army, but also more recently against political opponents. No justice for any of that. And then, of course, in the Central African Republic, which is in the middle of an ongoing sectarian crisis, with people still dying on a regular basis across the country, particularly in the capital, Bangui. And so I think what the Pope will say about justice and accountability is going to be really important. And in the past, the Vatican has talked about the need for justice to build peaceful solutions to problems and how important justice is for peace. And we very much hope the Pope will reiterate that message in all three of the countries he's going to be visiting.
Do you think the leaders of the countries will also put into place measures that will help alleviate some of the suffering of the people who are experiencing these abuses?
Certainly, there have been steps taken in the Central African Republic to put in place some mechanisms to try to bring justice. Those are in the very early stages, and to date, we haven't seen anyone being held to account for it yet. In Kenya and Uganda, the government has largely ignored questions of justice for these significant abuses that have taken place. And it will be interesting to see if the Pope makes comments about that, and specifically if he addresses that in his meetings with the various heads of state. You know, it's of course not the only question of human rights abuses that the Pope will be facing in all the countries that he will visit. You know, in two of the countries, Uganda and the Central African Republic, they're about to head into elections. And especially in Uganda, we've seen crackdowns already on free speech, on peaceful assembly, on the possibility for the opposition to organize, you know, a problem that is in fact hitting us across Africa. And here the Pope will be visiting a country where it is quite evident and where they're in the middle of a presidential election campaign.
Another expectation is the Pope speaking on religious tolerance and also tolerance for those of sexual and gender minorities.
The sexual and gender minorities is, of course, an issue across Africa. We have seen continued widespread violence against individuals of sexual and gender minorities. Certainly at Human Rights Watch, we don't expect that the Vatican is going to see eye to eye with us on everything in relation to the rights of the LGBT community. But this is a moment for the Pope to reiterate a message he has said in a number of other environments of stopping violence against people of sexual and gender minorities, and indeed condemning that violence. It will be important for the Pope to really reiterate the stance that he has said on occasion of not condoning this violence, of very much condemning it and showing tolerance for people of sexual and gender minorities. The same would go, we would say at Human Rights Watch, for those of ethnic minorities, particularly in Kenya, where individuals of Somali origin have been targeted in recent waves of violence, and of course in the Central African Republic, of people of the Muslim religion. And that should be really the strong message of tolerance and to stop discrimination. I very much hope it's going to be a key part of what the Pope will say.
That was Annika van Woudenberg, a spokesperson for Human Rights Watch. She spoke with me from London.
The Paris Climate Conference, known as COP21, opens November 30th. The goal is to reach a binding universal agreement on climate change, something 20 years of negotiations have failed to do so far. A new analysis says many countries agree the improvement in agriculture are necessary to ease the effects of rising global temperatures. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
The study says many countries have what it calls a huge appetite for technical assistance and financing for adaptation and mitigation strategies related to agriculture. The analysis of country-level climate plans was done by CGIAR, a global research agricultural partnership. Dr. Bruce Campbell is director of the organization's program for climate change, agriculture, and food security. He says the Paris summit is crucial.
Oh, goodness, this climate conference is probably one of the most important ones because it's really going to set agreement for the next decades.
Since climate talks have failed so many times before, Campbell lays out what needs to be done to reach an agreement.
I think that what we have to see is countries committing to sufficient actions to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and also sufficient finance to make sure adaptation happens, because we're already on a course for a warmer and changed climate, so we need to put in place adaptation as well as mitigation.
CGIAR says of the 160 parties participating in COP21, 80% have included agriculture in climate change mitigation targets or actions. At the same time, 64% say agriculture is important in climate adaptation strategies. Campbell says countries have made it clear that agriculture is a priority. Nevertheless, the study states that agriculture as a sector remains absent from the main draft text of the official UN climate negotiations. It describes that as a major disconnect between national-level planning and global-level policymaking.
Hopefully, the international commitment agrees that the national commitments are sufficient to deal with the climate problem. And so those national commitments will then become part of the international agreement.
But Campbell says it will be exceptionally challenging for developing countries to put in place both mitigation and adaptation strategies. He gives the example of rice farming.
Paddy rice emits large amounts of greenhouse gases, methane. If you change the production method, you can reduce greenhouse gases in paddy rice down to 30 to 50%, but it doesn't increase your yields. You have to put in extra effort to reduce the emissions, but you don't gain a lot out of it.
Therefore, developing countries may need financial help to make those changes, which include new methods to reduce water usage. Campbell says changes in livestock production in developing countries would also help. Overall, livestock contributes up to 55% of agricultural greenhouse gas emissions.
So, for example, in dairy farming, if we think of Africa, yeah, there's a rise in milk consumption in towns. If you improve the feed to the livestock, you do many things at the same time. First of all, you improve the amount of milk you get per animal. You increase the farmer's income, and you reduce the greenhouse gas emissions per unit of milk produced.
The International Livestock Research Institute and the World Agroforestry Center are testing measures to improve livestock feed for smallholder farms. CGIAR also recommends combining modern and traditional methods for making climate forecasts and sending that information to smallholder farmers by mobile phones and radio broadcasts. But Campbell adds, the question is, where will the support to implement those plans come from? He says so far, there has been exceptionally slow progress on these issues. The Paris Climate Conference runs from November 30th through December 11th. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to African News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more coming up next right here on The Voice of America. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Belgium's prime minister says the capital will be on the highest state of alert until at least next week. Malian authorities have asked the public for help in identifying two gunmen killed in the terrorist attack on a Bamako hotel on Friday. And Burundi's government suspends 10 civil society groups, accusing them of fueling violence that has left more than 200 people dead since April. Coming up, we'll have music from Gabon, and in our feature segment, in Zimbabwe, hunger forces the majority of school-aged children to drop out of school. I'm Kim Lewis with the Yeheya Swuhi. Bands, we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are starting off with Major League Soccer.
Kim, let's kick off with an update on the Major League Soccer playoffs. Four clubs remain in contention for the trophy, which will be awarded December 6th when the MLS Cup title game is played. In the Eastern Conference Final, the Columbus Crew lead the New York Red Bulls 2-0. The decisive second leg will be played November 29th at Red Bull Arena near New York City. And in the Western Conference Final, the Portland Timbers lead FC Dallas 3-1. The decisive second leg in that home-and-away series will also be played Sunday, November 29th, at Toyota Stadium in Texas. In action this past Sunday, striker Kai Kamara, who is from Sierra Leone, scored Columbus's second goal in that 2-0 victory over New York. The 31-year-old Kamara is enjoying his best season ever in Major League Soccer. He and Italian striker Sebastian Giovinco of Toronto FC tied for the MLS scoring title with 22 goals each. The 28-year-old Giovinco joined Toronto in January from the Italian club Juventus, and he was named Major League Soccer's Newcomer of the Year. The Big League Award, Most Valuable Player, will be announced on December 2nd. Getting back to Kai Kamara, in addition to that league scoring title, he won the MLS Humanitarian of the Year Award, given to the player who exemplifies both skill on the field and service within the community. Taking a look at some of the other MLS end-of-season awards, Liberia-born Darlington Nagbe of the Portland Timbers, who recently became a U.S. citizen, won the MLS Fair Player Award. That award is given to the player who exemplifies sportsmanlike behavior, in addition to receiving one of the lowest number of yellow and red cards, fouls, and disciplinary violations. And while Kamara and Giovinco each scored 22 goals during the regular season, Giovinco won the MLS Golden Boot Award as top scorer because he had more assists than Kamara. More MLS award winners, Belgian player Laurent Simon of the Montreal Impact was named the MLS Defender of the Year. Luis Robles of the New York Red Bulls was named the MLS Goalkeeper of the Year. And Kyle Larin of the Florida club Orlando City was named the MLS Rookie of the Year. And speaking of awards, let's take a short break now for this important message from a Congolese giant who was inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame in September.
This is Dikembe Mutombo. I am from Africa. Malaria kills thousands of children every day. Don't let your child be one of them. Make sure they sleep under a treated mosquito net. Beating malaria is like winning at basketball. You need to get to the net.
They're playing.
In National Basketball Association news, LeBron James of the Cleveland Cavaliers joined some very exclusive company on Monday night in Ohio. LeBron scored 15 points and had 13 assists to help the Cavaliers remain unbeaten at home this season with a 117-103 win over the Orlando Magic. In the process, LeBron joined Oscar Robertson as the only players in NBA history to rank in the top 25 in career points and assists. The Big O, Oscar Robertson, finished his Hall of Fame career with 26,710 points and 9,887 assists. So yeah, LeBron and the Big O, some very exclusive company. Elsewhere, Kevin Durant made a triumphant return from a hamstring injury. Durant scored 27 points and grabbed 6 rebounds to help the Oklahoma City Thunder beat the host Utah Jazz 111-89. It was Durant's first game for the Thunder since he got hurt November 10th right here in Washington, his birthplace. In Monday night's 5 other NBA games, the Miami Heat beat the New York Knicks 95-78 to snap New York's 4-game winning streak. The Charlotte Hornets defeated the Sacramento Kings 127-122 in overtime. Kemba Walker had 39 points for the Hornets. The 5-time NBA champion San Antonio Spurs defeated the visiting Phoenix Suns 98-84. The Minnesota Timberwolves topped the Philadelphia 76ers 100-95. Philadelphia is off to a horrible start this season. They've lost their first 15 games. And in one more NBA result, the Milwaukee Bucks beat the Detroit Pistons 109-88.
The Voice of America, VOA.
It's time to climb between the ropes once again with the VOA's undisputed and reigning prince of pugilistics, Nnamdi Hollywood Moeta. Good evening, Nnamdi.
And a good evening, Sonny.
Nnamdi, the Mexican star Canelo defeats Miguel Cotto over the weekend to win the vacant WBC middleweight title. You were ringside at the Mandalay Bay Hotel and Casino Events Center in Las Vegas, Nnamdi. First off, let's go to the scorecards and get your reaction. Unanimous decision for Canelo, 117-111, 119-109, and 118-110. Fair decision, Nnamdi?
All in favor of Canelo. A little bit wide. It could have been a little closer because some people felt the fight could have been a draw. And some people felt it should have been a little closer. But check this out. Some people felt, too, he should have paid that $300,000 by WBC and he would have been a little closer. You
and
know?
Then maybe the decision would look different.
Yeah, should have paid the $300,000 they demanded, you know.
So you're saying the judges could have been influenced by the WBC decision?
Yeah, because the president of the WBC, Mauricio Suleiman, was ringside, you know, and then he's the one that signs the checks for the judges, you know. I mean, come on, man, you know, you're fighting a Mexican and the president of the WBC is a Mexican and he's in the room. You better know what you're doing or you're not going to get the next assignment. You know?
Nnamdi, I watched the fight and I sort of agree with this one observer who said it looked like a natural middleweight in his prime, Canelo, beating an aging welterweight just past his prime, Cotto. Your thoughts?
Yes, at the age of 25, Canelo is still growing. And going into this fight, we talked about he may be able to cut off the ring and use his legs and push back Cotto. Cotto was unable to hurt Canelo. You could see Canelo was a prime middleweight, though he claims he's not 160 yet. So, but Cotto just hadn't, he didn't have the impact, you know, because pressure was on Cotto. He kept backing up all night.
So you're saying Canelo was never hurt by anything that Cotto threw?
No. Canelo had airtight defense plus his fast hands, and he was able to even look at the fight, look at his footwork. It kind of reminded me of Muhammad Ali's footwork, you know. You're looking at a fighter that's ready to fight, fan-friendly style, all action. He's got power in both hands, you know.
Nnamdi, you talk about that fan-friendly style of Canelo. Were the fans rooting for Canelo, or were they split in terms of
the cheers?
It was a little bit more like a 60-40 split right there, because the Mexicans, they come out and they like action, you know. And their man was just delivering action, and the blows were just like the body shots, the movement, the jabs. He was delivering, and everybody were on their feet, you know. I mean, look back, 6 months ago, millions of people opened their wallet only to feel cheated by this fight of the century, you know, Manny Pacquiao and Floyd Mayweather. But for this fight to end the year with all action, nobody complained. There was no knockdown, but, you know, we had a great time.
Nnamdi, as you told our VOA boxing fans last week, the WBC stripped Cotto of his WBC title for not paying sanctioning fees. Now the belt goes to Canelo. What's next for Canelo in terms of WBC requirements?
Well, Sonny, when they made a deal, there was a stipulation that allowed the fight Saturday night to happen. It was that the winner must begin negotiations with Triple G in 15 days. Because Triple G, mind you, is a WBA and IBF champion, but he's a WBC number one mandatory fighter. So will Canelo and Oscar De La Hoya start negotiating with Triple G? We will see.
How do you see that fight, Nnamdi, Triple G against Canelo?
I've always believed that Triple G is all hype, Sonny. Triple G have not really fought anybody, you know. I mean, Triple G with Canelo is going to be huge, because the Mexican fans, they love Canelo. It's their number one guy. It's going to be a great fight. The kind of fight is a fight that will go into the Los Angeles Coliseum or the Cowboy Stadium in Dallas. That fight is enough to draw 100,000 people. But in a big fight like that, we have to negotiate. We have to look at pay-per-view numbers, Sonny. The last Triple G fight was 150,000.
Thanks, Nnamdi. That's our reigning prince of pugilistics, Nnamdi Hollywood Moueta. And we'll hear more verbal jabs from Nnamdi later this week. If you tuned into Monday's Sunny Side of Sports, you heard me report on Haile Gebrselassie's symbolic farewell race, the Great Ethiopian Run on Sunday in Addis Ababa. I posted a photo of Haile at my Facebook page. The address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. George Otieno in Nairobi, Kenya, saw the Haile photo, and George wrote, "Go for it, great Haile." Afolabi Ayo, no address given, wrote, "Great runner. Everything and everyone has an ending, Haile. Athletics will never forget you." And I echo those words by Afolabi Ayo. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Okay, thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up in Zimbabwe, hunger forces the majority of school-age children to drop out of school. And next, women rights activists in South Sudan want more women appointed to ministerial positions. But first, some music. Here is Oliver Ngoma from Gabon with Mouwe.
Kalina.
samedi, rendez-vous à l'économie.
Oh, Miguelito.
Gabon's Oliver Ngoma with Maye.
Well, the Zimbabwe Ministry of Education recently reported an alarming number of school dropouts in the country as parents struggle with school fees. But in remote Binga Matabeleland North, parents say it's not only about school fees, it's also about hunger that has forced the majority of school-aged children to drop out of school. Patricia Mudadigwa of VOA's Zimbabwe Service reports.
Speaking in Mcheso, which is about 80 kilometers from Binga town, parents say the current drought that the area is experiencing has forced their children to stay at home. Poverty is written all over the area, with many parents lamenting their situation. They are all looking up to the skies, hoping the heavens will break and bring them the much-needed rains. Aida Sibanda, who has two school-going children who had to travel about 7 kilometers to get to school, said she was forced to stop them from attending classes at Mcheso Primary School as they had no energy to walk back and forth and participate in classes.
Yeah, at Binga, we've got a big problem of drought. We don't have food. Children are not going to school just because of hunger. So the causes of hunger is that last year rain was not many. So the sun heated the crops, so we didn't manage to get more food for supporting our children.
Another villager, Mrs. Mulea, told Studio 7 that because of their desperate situation, they are appealing to humanitarian organizations who hardly assist this area to intervene and save their lives.
There was a shortage of rainfall. This causes the crops to die. So children, they are not going to school because of hunger. So we are asking for help so that children will go to school to learn.
Nyoni Mwembwe told Studio 7 that besides the shortage of food, sources of water drying up in the area, with villagers being forced to share the few sources of water with their animals. Most are traveling long distances to fetch water. According to a report published in July 2015 by the Zimbabwe Vulnerability Assessment Committee, some 1.5 million, 16% of the rural population, who have insufficient means to meet their minimum food needs during the 2015-2016 lean season. It is highly unlikely that the cash-strapped Harare will be able to feed all hungry Zimbabweans as had been promised earlier in the year. Most rural communities in the country are looking up to non-governmental organizations for food aid. Reporting in Binga, this is Patricia Mdadigwa.
Mm-hmm. Women rights activists in South Sudan want more women appointed to ministerial positions in the expected transitional government of national unity. The agreement states that 9 female ministers should be appointed to the transitional government. Activists say this quota is lower than the 25% policy for women representation in all government institutions, which is already required by the transitional constitution. Philip Tonaliu reports from Juba.
Nyanton, a Jamaican host, presented a paper on the role of women in peace building during a public lecture organized by the SAD Institute. She says women played a key role during the peace talks and must be actively involved in the peace deal. Host says the agreement specifies the number of women to be appointed to the national government, but says nothing about how many women should be appointed to state governments.
It is very important that the IO and the government and the other political party to observe the 25% within the representations, make sure that women are involved in all the activities.
Who says military commanders are not the only ones who should be given prominent positions in the transitional government of national unity.
Women doesn't have to be at the front line to fight, but women are key stakeholders within the conflict. Women take different roles. Definitely, there are women that we can say that they're actually at the front line.
Woman activist Margaret Matiang agrees. She says the transitional government will have 9 female ministers, including 4 to be nominated by the government and 3 by the SPLM-IO. She points out that number is lower than the 25% female representation in all government institutions as provided for in 2011 transitional constitution.
When a South Sudanese woman see a woman in a position of decision-making, she always feel proud that she's represented, and she can easily bring her issues to, reach out to that person who is in that responsibility so that her views can be heard.
Matiang says the role of women will be particularly important for peace building in a post-conflict South Sudan.
When people started fighting, many women thought this is a war between, the elephants. But the people who suffered most are women and children. So peace is a public demand, especially for women and children.
Agulde Chut, another women rights activist attending the lecture, says women should not limit their scope to political participation. Chut says the peace agreement is an opportunity to address issues affecting women in villages. Chut says women groups must expand their outreach and fight cultural norms that prevent girls from going to school, such as early child marriages. For VOA News, I am Philip Tonaleo in Juba.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Linus Rimkus, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. The United States condemns terrorist attacks on Tuesday, November 17th and Wednesday, November 18th that reportedly killed more than 40 innocent people in Nigeria. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, expressed her condolences to the families of the victims, noting that joint efforts to counter Boko Haram continue. 15 people were reportedly killed and several dozens injured in the northern city of Kano when two girls, said to be aged 11 and 18, detonated bombs, killing themselves and bystanders in a busy moment.
This is a special report from VOA News. Less than 2 weeks after the deadly attack in Paris, U.S. President Barack Obama has welcomed his French counterpart, François Hollande, to the Oval Office for talks that were expected to go beyond America showing solidarity for its oldest ally, a grieving France. We're awaiting a joint appearance by both men live from the White House. People have been gathered there, have reporters for the past half hour or so, while presumably the two presidents have been reaching some kind of agreements which might be announced momentarily. We are awaiting their appearance in what appears to be the East Room of the White House here in Washington. Now, President Hollande's trip here to the U.S. Capitol follows by a day his meeting with the British Prime Minister, David Cameron, who pledged France some new assistance for its airstrikes against Islamic State militants in Syria. One could presume that he is asking the U.S. President Barack Obama for the same kind of assistance. Cameron on Monday said he would ask the British Parliament for approval to join the fight against the jihadists while offering up a British air base in Cyprus for French fighter jets to launch their attacks on Islamic State targets. Now, during today's talks at the White House, the French leader was expected to press the American president, as we said, to commit more assets in the fight against the Islamic State as Hollande enlists international support for a coordinated attack on the militants. When asked about potential deliverables, that's what they're called, from the Obama-Hollande meeting, the White House press secretary, Josh Earnest, said on Monday he didn't want to downplay the significance of expressions of solidarity and support. The White House spokesman told reporters Monday, and this is a quote, that this is a time when the French people are grieving and knowing that they can count on the most powerful country to have their back as they determine what's necessary to strengthen homeland security in their own country, but also to take the fight to ISIL or Daesh or ISIS, as one might call them. He said, I think this will be a source of significant comfort to the French people. Again, we are awaiting the appearance of the two men who are now walking down the